You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara County, and streaming across the globe at kpfk.org, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, along with many other hate-driven harms, the budget bill put Stephen Miller's cruel and bizarre mass deportation plan on steroids. $45 billion for building new immigration detention centers. That's a 62% larger budget than the entire federal prison system. Those goons hiding their faces and their IDs while they snatch people off the street, ICE's enforcement and deportation operations get $30 billion more dollars. $46 billion for a border wall, because evidently that's not a cartoon. And in a lesser noticed piece, while courts are backlogged with immigrants complying with legal processes to access citizenship, the bill caps the number of immigration judges at 800, ensuring that many more people will be kept in vulnerable legal status. The Economic Policy Institute tells us that increases in immigration enforcement will cause widespread job losses for both immigrant and U.S.-born workers, particularly in construction and childcare. Quote, while Trump and other conservatives claim that increased deportations will somehow magically create jobs for U.S.-born workers, the existing evidence shows that the opposite is true. They will cause immense harm to workers and families, shrink the economy, and weaken the labor market for everyone, close quote. And that's without mentioning how ICE is telling people they're being moved from Texas to Louisiana and then dumping them in South Sudan, as The Intercept's Nick Terse reports, or the puerile delight Republicans seem to find in holding people in an alligator swamp and forbidding journalists and public officials from even seeing what's going on there. It's important to see that Donald Trump, while especially craven, is using tools he was given, in terms of the apparatus for mass deportations, including in the acceptance of prisons as economic boons for struggling localities. So the fight can't be just anti-Trump, but has to be rooted in policy and practice and law, and most of all in community and shared humanity. We'll talk about standing up for human beings because they're human beings with Silky Shaw, Executive Director of Detention Watch Network. That's coming up today on Counterspin, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. Emily Sanders of Exxon News, a project of the Center for Climate Integrity, cross-posted a report with Emily Atkins of the climate crisis newsletter Heated on the deadly flash floods in Texas. The severity of the flooding was both exceedingly rare and a convergence of very predictable circumstances, Sanders explained. In a region called Flash Flood Alley, the combination of hills and nearly impermeable drought-parched soil made for an unstoppable deluge when more than a foot of rain fell fast. She adds, it's the type of climate-fueled disaster that's becoming more frequent and severe all over the country due to fossil fuel pollution. As heat-trapping gases concentrate in the atmosphere, the Earth's water cycle is intensified, leading to more severe torrential downpours when rainfall does occur. An analysis published Monday by research partnership Climameter found that climate change intensified the rainfall that caused the flooding in Texas. Well, Texas is the top oil-producing state in the country. Chevron and Exxon have their headquarters there, and Texan leaders are refusing to acknowledge climate change or fossil fuels as even a potential contributor to the floods that have killed, well, as we record, 120 people. Governor Greg Abbott said, quote, "Ever since I have been governor, we have had weather events that were completely unpredictable, and that is just a part of nature," close quote. Abbott got more than $1 million from the oil and gas industries just in 2024. But here's the thing. Fossil fuel companies aren't pretending their work has no role in climate disruption and resulting weather patterns. Less than a month before the fatal floods, the American Gas Association huddled up with industry and utility representatives, along with people from the National Governors Association, the Department of Energy, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to talk about how to prepare pipeline infrastructure and the energy grid, quote, "for high-demand seasons and severe weather events," close quote. That's according to leaked audio from the event. Exxon, Mobil, Shell, and others have been preparing their own infrastructure for big storms and rising seas for decades, even as they vigorously fought any regulation of fossil fuels. In fact, internal documents show a plan to discredit anyone drawing connections between climate change and extreme weather, even as those industries were battling regulations to curb the use of fossil fuels. As the Houston Chronicle's Chris Tomlinson wrote, quote, "Every appointed state official knows they could be fired for acknowledging global warming, which is why you never hear it discussed at the Public Utility Commission, the Railroad Commission, or even the Texas Commission for Environmental Quality," close quote. All manner of scrutiny is needed, Sanders concludes. But so far, little of that scrutiny is landing on how elected officials' ongoing relationships with the fossil fuel industry could continue to cost lives. You are listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. As is being reported, including by Belen Fernandez for FAIR.org, among the myriad horrors of Trump's budget bill, though not his alone, everyone who voted for it owns it, is the otherworldly amount of money, $175 billion, slated to fund mass deportation. That exceeds the military budget of every country in the world but the U.S. and China. And some $30 billion is to go to ICE, the masked goons that are descending on swap meets and workplaces to carry out what many are calling brazen midday kidnappings. We knew that this White House would be horrible for black and brown people and for immigrants especially. And yet we can still be shocked at how bad and how fast things are happening. Despair might be understandable, but it's not particularly useful. So what do we do? What can we do? Joining us now is Silke Shah, Executive Director at Detention Watch Network. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Silke Shah.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we see the narrative shifting. You know, hey, he said it was just going to be violent criminals or people whose crime is administrative. But now, this is getting weird. What's happening now, the rounding up of anyone brown, basically, including people who are actively engaged in the legal processes of securing citizenship, we can be outraged, but I'm less sure about surprised, just because there was no decent way to do what Trump telegraphed he wanted to do. At the same time, though, I don't know that anyone really expected masked men spilling out of vans to snatch up children off the street. So, I mean, just first of all, did you even imagine the particular situation we're seeing right now? You explained back in January how the apparatus were set up, but is this surprising even at your level of understanding?
I think what's so shocking about this moment is that the scale of what has happened before is becoming astronomical. So, as you mentioned, $175 billion for immigration enforcement, $30 billion for ICE agents in particular, $35 billion for immigration detention. These are just wild numbers, and I think that is really what is so shocking. I do think, you know, we're speaking here on Counterspin. I think one of the biggest challenges of the last 20, 30 years of immigration enforcement and how it's been portrayed is that there is a constant sort of framing of immigration is a public safety issue. Immigration is a national security issue, which is really not true. Mostly immigration is about labor. It's about family relationships. It's about seeking refuge. And I think what's so frustrating is that actually for many, many years of having this narrative of some immigrants are deserving and some immigrants aren't, the good immigrant versus the bad immigrant, what ends up happening is kind of where we're at now, which is like all immigrants are perceived as a problem. And there's no question that there's an underlying racism and xenophobia and classism and all the other things at play here. And so I think what's so important for us to understand now when we're talking about the way ICE is operating is that it's been enabled by that framework that, you know, when you reinforce this idea that some people are deserving, then you kind of expect everybody to be in that category. Right. And that's what sort of happened is that, you know, in reality, the way the system worked before is that people were being funneled through the criminal legal system. And this really skyrocketed the number of people who are in deportation proceedings, especially under the Obama administration. So this was all happening. So this framework of we are going to target people who are quote unquote criminals, it's kind of a distraction. The goal is to scapegoat immigrants and all immigrants,
right?
And, you know, ignore the sort of crisis of mass incarceration, which ICE is inherently a part of.
Well, where is the law in all of this? Is it that there are laws that exist but aren't being enforced? Is it that the law has changed such that what we're seeing is terrible, but, you know, lamentably legal? Do laws need to be changed? I think a lot of folks see, you know, masked men spilling out of vans and snatching kids and think that can't be legal. But is it?
Well, I think there are some aspects of this that have been baked into the law for 30 years now, and some aspects that are new. And so I think it's important to understand that when you think about this sort of initial framing of, oh, people are being disappeared and kidnapped came when a lot of students who had protested or expressed solidarity with Palestine were being targeted by ICE, many of whom had not had contact with the criminal legal system, many of whom who had legal status in some form, including green cards and visas. And so in that context, you know, 30 years ago in 1996, when they passed the 1996 immigration laws, it actually started to expand the category of people who didn't get due process, who wouldn't, you know, didn't have the right to due process. That included newly arriving immigrants and also people who were legal permit residents or had visas but had some crime, some conviction that meant that they no longer had a right to, you know, make their case before a judge and were required to be detained, required to be deported. And so all of that stuff has been happening for decades now. And there are many aspects of what happened, you know, being separated from your family, even if you have a pregnant wife, all those things are quite normal. And also not having a warrant. I mean, ICE goes after immigrants all the time without a warrant. And, you know, a lot of our work has been to help people know their rights, know what is needed. But I think the thing that's scary is that they're actually using immigration enforcement as a pretense to go after people who don't agree with their ideas, you know, people who might be showing support for Palestine or merely because they are Black and brown and are an easy scapegoat for this administration. So I think there are things that are happening outside of the scope of the law. And I think the sort of test cases here are those students who were detained and also the case of the many people who were sent to mega prison in El Salvador. I think those are instances where you're just like, wow, that is definitely outside of law. And they're operating in these ways that are really concerning. But they're also using these as strategies to kind of change the law, which is what we saw recently with the men who were being deported to South Sudan, were stuck in Djibouti for many weeks, and now officially are in South Sudan, and the Supreme Court deeming that okay.
It's bizarre. You mentioned last time how much local and state level buy-in is required for this whole plan to work. Yes, there's ICE. Yes, there is the Trump administration, but they do rely on state and local law enforcement and other officials to make this play out. Is that still a place to look for resistance then?
Absolutely. And I think it's especially important now that we double down on those efforts because, you know, yes, ICE is going to have $45 billion more dollars over the next 4 years to build more detention centers. And our goal is to block that in every way and make sure that isn't permanent. And a lot of our strategy is getting local officials, state officials to do that work, to say, no, like, we don't want a new ICE detention center in our community. Once their ICE detention exists in a community, people are much more likely to be targeted for deportation. Detention exists to facilitate deportation. And so in places like Illinois and Oregon, for instance, there are no detention centers, and that actually helps protect communities that much more. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of Democratic governors are responding in ways that are not ideal. I think in, you know, places like California and Washington State and other places, there needs to be a lot of work to say, no, we have to double down on these policies that have protected immigrant communities and expand them and make sure that those transfers to ICE aren't happening so that we can limit ICE's reach as much as possible. It's still the most effective way to prevent them from getting the scale of deportations they want. The easiest way for them to do this is through these sort of ICE police collaborations, and stopping that is essential. But also, you know, in places like Florida, where Ron DeSantis is doing everything possible to work with ICE and building things like this Everglades detention camp and having agreements with ICE at every county jail. And there's been numerous deaths actually in Florida already of people who have been in ICE custody. And so it really shows you the harm that that sort of relationship between state and local law enforcement does to make ICE even that much stronger. So I think there is this constant attention on ICE, but we have to understand that ICE operates within a broader apparatus around criminalization and the deportation machine that many, many law enforcement agencies, including sheriff, are central to.
And just to add to that, it's about money, as you've explained. It comes back to money. Prisons, we can call them detention centers, bring money to a locality, right? And so that is part of the unseen or underexplored aspect of this, is that when you build a holding cell, you know, then you're going to put people in it. And that is part of what explains what's happening.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that this is so about the political economy, and some people have referred to this new sort of MAGA murder bill as like a jobs program.
Right.
You know, like if you have this much more money for ICE, this much more money for detention, that means more jobs in these communities. And this is what we saw for years and years during the prison boom, is that many rural communities that were struggling financially were seeing prison as like a, you know, recession-safe economy, like an ability to bring in jobs. And especially when it comes to the relationship between sheriffs and ICE, there's like a sort of symbiosis there between the federal government and local counties, that local counties are really depending on this revenue. I think one of our biggest challenges when we're trying to work to end a detention contract is that fear of losing jobs and that fear of losing that revenue.
Well, let me just ask you, feeding off of that, to talk about communities, not cages. What is the vision there? What are you talking about there? And where can folks see another way forward?
Yeah, we launched a Communities Not Cages campaign many years ago under Trump's first term, and we're actually about to relaunch because the amount of money that's going to this system, the scale of what's going to happen, I think we need to like bring a lot more people in. But a lot of it was kind of actually responding to local organizing against detention. So we were seeing in places like Alabama and Georgia and Arizona and elsewhere that people were, you know, calling attention to the existing detention system and the harm that it was doing, the number of deaths that were happening, people hunger striking in facilities. We were trying to really do work to get resources to them, make sure people are strategizing together. And then in places like the Midwest, for years, so many groups were doing work to stop a new detention center from coming in. ICE wanted to have one large detention center in Illinois or Indiana or elsewhere, and they tried to build it in 9 or 10 different sites. And at every site, they were able to organize with local community or work with the state legislature to stop detention expansion. And so what we did was bring a lot of these communities together, the people who are organizing this campaign, thinking about state legislation, thinking about strategies with local counties or city councils, to learn from each other and figure out, okay, what can we do? Because, you know, one of the things we discovered, and we did some research on this, is that when there's a detention center in your community, so if you have, say, 50 beds for detention, somebody's 2 times more likely to be targeted for deportation. If you have 800 beds, somebody's 6 times more likely to be targeted for deportation. And so that ability to cut off the detention capacity actually prevented increased deportation. And so we really see Communities Not Cages as a part of the strategy to end the sort of like mass deportation agenda, and also really connect to that broader effort against the prison industrial complex and against the crisis of mass incarceration, which does so much harm and are really, you know, I think Mariam Cabo has called them death-making institutions. I mean, we're seeing that numerous deaths have just happened in the last few weeks. And so we're really concerned about the conditions right now. I'm the first person to say, you know, Trump is building on what a bipartisan agenda for decades now against immigrants. But the scale of what's happening and how abysmal these facilities are becoming are even shocking to me as somebody who's been doing this work for 20 years. And so I think this is the time where we can't give in. Yes, they got this $45 billion, but actually we have a lot of ability to stop them from implementing their plans. And we really need to, you know, gear up and fight as much as we can.
Well, that sounds very much like an end, and yet I am going to push for one final question because we need a positive vision. You know, what we're seeing, what's passing for a positive vision on immigration right now is, but he makes my tacos, you know, like he waters my lawn. Don't come for him. And it makes immigration feel like noblesse oblige. You know, it's very nice of us that we let them live here. And we can debunk all day. You know, immigrants do pay taxes. They aren't stealing jobs. It's also mean and small as a vision. And I just feel that there's a positive forward-looking vision that we could be talking about.
I think one of the most challenging things about the way the sort of mainstream immigrant advocacy efforts over the last 20 years has hurt our ability to make the case for immigrants is that they've really reinforced the idea of the good immigrant versus bad immigrant. And when they're talking about the quote unquote good immigrant, a lot of it really pushes this idea of immigrant exceptionalism or productivity or, you know, immigrants are better than everyone else. Mm-hmm. Like this, you know, mm-hmm. often there's this narrative of immigrants commit less crimes than U.S. citizens, which just reinforces both anti-Black racism and the idea that immigration is about public safety, which it's not. And so, again, as I was saying before, I mean, immigration is really largely about labor and family relationships and also the root causes of migration. I mean, a lot of the narrative hasn't allowed us to talk about U.S. empire and the role that the U.S. has played right. in sort of destabilizing a lot of other countries and conditions for people across the world. And so I think when I think about a vision, and I hope that we can move forward in a different way, is that actually, you know, part of the reason immigrants have been able to be scapegoated is because the U.S. government and billionaires have created a crisis, an economic crisis for so many people. And what we really need to understand is that immigrants are central to our community, that we are in this together, you know, like having better health care, having better, more affordable housing, having better education opportunities. Those things are going to make it easier for us to make the case for immigrants. So I think actually we need to really deeply show that immigration is kind of connected to every issue, whether it be climate, whether it be housing, et cetera, all these things, and see us in it together and think about this as a question of like a broader question of working people, working class, poor people, and really not exceptionalizing immigrants. And the other thing I would just say is that in so many ways, immigration detention in particular as being sort of treated as an aside, as this like other issue, mm-hmm. small, not big, and like whatever, there's mass incarceration, there's deportation, but now it's being used as a testing ground for Trump's authoritarianism. And so we really need to see that actually the way they're operating around immigration creates risks for all of us. And again, the reason why it's so important that we see our struggles intertwined and that we work together on.
We've been speaking with Silke Shah from the Detention Watch Network. They're online at detentionwatchnetwork.org. Thank you so much, Silke Shah, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to learn about our newsletter Extra and to show much needed support for Counterspin if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Michael Cherry. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
The benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being able to reduce your taxable income. There's no need to deal with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process. To donate your vehicle, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
In terms of how you report the world, you also bring up the fact that large newspapers like the New York Times, they'll never let you stay in a foreign bureau more than 3 to 5 years because of what you write about, this reality of difference. Explain what that is and why it buttresses not only our ignorance, but a particular worldview.
Yeah. The reality of difference is means, very simply, American ideology, if I can use that blanket term, requires that we distinguish ourselves as the exceptional people on the face of the earth, and all others are in one measure others, right? If you're talking about the French or the British, okay, they are a friendly people, sympathetic people, but they are fundamentally different from us. You know, their systems are different. Well, French have quite a good healthcare system, but that's France. They're different, right? When you get to non-Western people, beginning at the top of the pyramid with the Japanese and on down, they are really very different. And to report those sort of places, from the beginning of my career, was interested in non-Western countries, third world problems and all that. These people are profoundly sort of, if I may say, otherized, right? And you report them as almost specimens, right? You report them from behind a pane of glass through which you will never pass. You mentioned the standard tour for a correspondent, 3 to 5 years. That's right. because after that period, correspondents tend to understand the country or countries they're reporting a little too well for the foreign editor's taste, right? Wait a minute, you're actually writing about this country from their perspective. You're showing us the world the way it looks to these people. No, if you were in Berlin, you got to go to Buenos Aires now, right? Start all over again. Don't understand others too thoroughly.
The point is, you begin not only to understand them, you begin to understand us.
Yeah, they're all
mirrors. That's what they don't want.
Yeah, I mean, the correspondent, a good one, the light bulb goes on some years into an assignment. I am asking 1,000 questions, and as I get the answers, I'm learning about myself. Right.
And there's another aspect you lift up, which I think is important. You talk about how Western correspondents covering the non-West defactualized the story. And you're right about that. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, my experience was primarily, my formative years as a correspondent were late 70s, the height of the Cold War, or maybe a little past its peak, but still a very serious reality, right? And I've reported primarily in East Asia, not only in East Asia, but primarily. And you had the dictatorships in Korea, Indonesia, the famous case of the Marcoses in the Philippines, so to speak, strongman governments in Malaysia, places like that, right? And then the Japanese case, we reinvented the Japanese after the 45 defeat and installed the Liberal Democratic Party and made sure it stayed there, installed, right? we couldn't report these phenomena as they were. We couldn't proceed into the zone of cause and effect. How did the South Korean dictators get there? How did Suharto get there in 65 when Sukarno, who I love Sukarno, he was one of the great people of the 20th century, when he was deposed in a CIA operation? These things could not be discussed. It was all about, in the case of the Japanese miracle, right? There was no miracle in Japan. It was what I call a Cold War social contract. America committed to buying the exports of all these countries. This is why the East Asians are so addicted to exports. Committed to buying the exports of these countries so that they could make a social contract with their citizens that went this way. We will give you material prosperity. You can have a refrigerator or a color TV or a little tiny Japanese car, maybe for the first time in your family's history. But you can't touch politics. That's the deal. Right. But we couldn't. You could watch this if you were alert and immune to the ideological ruts. You could understand it, but you couldn't write about it. Right.
This raises the other point, and that is the absence of context, absence of history. I like Robert Fisk. I don't know if you knew Bob.
I didn't know him, but I certainly knew of him.
Yeah. Yeah, and his book, The Great War for Civilization, which is a great book on the modern Middle East, but it marries his reporting. He was in the Middle East for 44 years. It marries his reporting with his deep understanding of history. But if you don't understand the history, then and nothing is contextualized, then when you get an eruption, for instance, on October 7th by the Palestinians with incursion into Israel, because it's not put in context, it's presented within the media as incomprehensible, and with it, the people who carried it out become incomprehensible.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, this happens, I don't need to tell you, Chris, this happens as a matter of daily routine as we speak, right? Context is an essential context in history. I had a list of five things: context, history, causality, agency, and responsibility are all essential for us to understand events in the world around us. And none is permitted to any effective extent in corporate media. Things happen out of nowhere. Why did that happen? Well, those other people, there's no explaining them, right? it doesn't make sense to us because we're different from them, etc., right? Here's a good one. Here's a perfect one for us. The unprovoked Russian military operation in Ukraine, unprovoked. That is the stripping out of history and context, plain and simple. It's in this case, it's so boldly deceitful. You don't have to be a graduate student in history at the University of Wisconsin to know what went on before February 24th, 2022, 30 years of it, right? And then the coup in 2014, the 8 years of bombardment, savage bombardment of Russian speakers in the East, it's all there. But, you know, the media erase it with exceptional daring, The force of media, the force of incessant presentation makes this kind of thing so regrettably effective, right? Yeah, that's what we mean by context. Perfect example.
I want to talk about a quote from the book, The Eclipse of Reason. Reason as an organ for perceiving the true nature of reality and determining the guiding principles of our lives, this is Horkheimer writes, has come to be regarded as obsolete. And you write, this surrender to the irrational does great damage to the surrendering society, as is evident as we look out our windows. It is near to fatal for the practice of journalism. Talk about that surrender to the irrational.
I like that book, Horkheimer's book. It's not a very long book. It's a very accessible book. If any of your listeners or reviewers are interested in finding it, you can find it on the used book sites, The Eclipse of Reason. What he was talking about, and this was 1947 that was published, listeners take note, that was the beginning of the Cold War, right? He's talking about the Socratic process of reasoning is you take a circumstance and you advance through the known universe of facts and evidence, and you arrive at a conclusion. You are not in charge of the conclusion. What you learn on the way will lead you to the correct conclusion. This has been turned upside down in our hyper-ideological polity, such that you draw your conclusion first and then you reason backwards, right? Russiagate, a perfect example. This is how it has to come out. Now let's reason backwards to support the conclusion we've already drawn. It's a living disaster for our profession, given that we trade in facts and evidence and research, as the wonderful Bob Perry put it, he's in the book briefly. I don't care what the truth is. I just care what the truth is. That's out the window now. I care what the truth is, and I'm going to make a case to support my version of the truth. It's not an operative way to conduct yourself as a journalist. But pick up any major daily; that's what you're reading, right?
I want to talk. It's a small point, but it, of course, resonated with me because I've experienced it. They don't ever embrace the ideology they promote, but the way that they censor, and you're writing about one of your own experiences, you say stories written beyond the ideological fence posts are never thrown back for that reason, as the fence posts cannot be acknowledged. It is always, we want better sourcing, or not enough solid reporting here, or the catch-all, you don't support your case.
You must have...
Yeah, I've been there.
I can sense I'm ringing some of your bells here, right? I laid that out because any professional reading the book will say, oh my God, yeah, that, right? I recounted one of my direct experiences when in my latter days at the Herald Tribune, the New York Times had bought out the... Washington. It was a condominium ownership. The New York Times owned 50% and the Post owned 50%.
Yeah, but let me just interrupt, Patrick. Yeah. It was a good newspaper because it had editorial independence from
Yeah, Post. And the head office was in Paris.
Right.
It made a big difference. But anyway, the Times made the Post a very unpleasant offer it couldn't refuse. And so the Times suddenly owned all of
well,
it.
Well, they threatened to destroy the Herald Tribune. Let's be clear. It was like the mafia.
You know the story. And so the Times, the Trib, you know, it was one of those publications where there was that space we were discussing earlier. Right? The Trib began the process of Timesification. That is the the occasion for the the one experience I had, right? I had been editing the Asian edition. They took me off of that because they needed a Times man. And they made me sort of a roving correspondent for the region, right? Okay, I kind of thought my correspondent days were over, but I said, all right, let's try this. And I wrote a story that I knew very, I thought, you better get this over with. You better determine once and for all who these people are. I wrote a story for them that was a very good Herald Tribune story. No ideology, kind of a worldly perspective, not informed by any kind of nationalist orthodoxy, you know, just look at things the way they are. This is one reason I think the location of the Trib's newsroom in Paris was important. Write that story and see what happens.
Let me just interrupt. It was a story about the decline of American influence and hegemony.
Yeah, exactly.
The rise of what we call a multipolar world.
That's right.
China.
Right. Russia, China, Iran, peripherally, you know, as I say in the book, I'll eat my hat or anything else people propose if that story written in 2006 is not the world that's out our windows today, right? So I wrote the story and I filed the story, and it came back from my editor with all these, not really objections, but do a little more work here, right? As I say in the piece, in the book, the piece was brass plated by the time I gave it to them because I knew it would face headwinds. My editor in Hong Kong finally gave up. I answered all his questions, so he sent it to Paris. The newsroom in Paris raised all sorts of other questions. I answered those questions. They still didn't want to publish it. They sent it to New York. And then the foreign editor, some national security correspondents whose name I'd love to mention but won't, and some bureau chiefs in Asia had a look at it, right? Now, the conflicts of interest are glow in the dark. I had a story they didn't have. And they went on and on about, one of them said, oh, tired old sources, you know. Another one said, what I repeated in the book, poorly sourced, can't tell what it's about, and so on. And finally, it popped out the other end of the pipeline from my editor in Hong Kong. Patrick, we just can't run this. That's all. We just can't run this. You're talking about the upper echelons of American journalism. As I say in the book, I have a great affection for that phrase ever since, the upper echelons of American journalism. That's what happens. Nobody at any time, this is your point, nobody at any time could say, Patrick, this is not the orthodoxy. We're defending American primacy here, and you're questioning it. That was the rub. But that can't be said.
Right? So there's a, Cy Hirsch wrote a great memoir, Reporter, which everyone should read. But he recounts exactly a long investigative piece he did on Gulf and Western. Very similar process. He left the paper not long after that. But before we close, I want to ask, because I have a slight disagreement with you. You hold up WikiLeaks, the coverage of the Vietnam War, Watergate, all as moments of integrity. That may not be your word in American journalism. I don't. The Vietnam War, for me, the coverage changed once public opinion changed. The press is a reactive force. It doesn't lead. In terms of Watergate, all of those tactics, this is Noam Chomsky, had been used on anti-war groups and dissidents, the Black Panthers, including assassinating Fred Hampton. But the press didn't care about it until the elite started devouring their own, i.e. the Republican administration of Nixon went after the Democratic Party. And in the case of WikiLeaks, and I was at the New York Times, I think that they were shamed by not publishing the revelations of WikiLeaks, they would have been exposed yeah. for who they were. They did, though, that publication, a collaboration with Julian Assange with their teeth grit and knew the moment the ink was dry, their next step was to destroy Julian Assange. I just comment briefly on that, and then I want to talk about where we're going.
Okay. I understand. I mean, what you seem to be saying is the political environment counted in all of these cases. Watergate would not have happened if considerable factions of the Washington power elite had turned against Nixon. the coverage we in the profession and others, I suppose, admire from Vietnam, Halberstam, Malcolm Brown, Milshi, and all those people, right? I don't think that coverage would have come to be if considerable portions of the power elite in Washington, the policy cliques, and of course the anti-war movement hadn't turned against the war, okay? That's what I mean by political environment counts. WikiLeaks, I hadn't thought of it the way you do. They were embarrassed. I remember in autumn of 2010, when there was a big release of WikiLeaks documents, I can't remember which ones they were.
2010 were the Iraqi war logs.
Yeah, okay. I remember on the front page of the Times, David Sanger, happy to mention his name, acknowledged that the Times has checked with the administration to make sure of what we can publish and what we can't. You tell that story later on, people can't believe it, but it was there, and it's routine. Okay, I think the key. I had it a little differently than you. I took it that the corporate media, mainstream press, saw in the Assange operation a real change in what journalism could be. But I think you might be closer to the mark. They had no choice. The key moment, I think, is when Pompeo, the odious Pompeo, gave a speech at CSIS, I think, and called Assange a Russian actor, all these phrases they make up, and turned on him. That was, forgive me my dates, 2011, 2012. So that's when the media turned and said, okay, we can go after this guy now. And he became a sort of, as I recount in the book, a sort of sacred outcast, right? And they went right to town on Assange, just in the way you have suggested.
Well, WikiLeaks threatened their entire model of journalism.
Yeah.
I mean, they had to destroy him.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, because I know, I was inside with Bill Keller and all these other, they hated.
Were you still inside the paper at that time?
In 2010, no. But of course, I know all these people. I mean, I know them and well. I mean, Keller was my foreign editor before he became executive editor. No, they had a vested interest in the moment it was published in destroying Julian. I want to talk about closing by independent media. Independent media has always been the check on the commercial press that goes back, to Ida B. Wells and before, the great crusading journalist set up her newspaper in Memphis that exposed the reality of lynching, which was nothing about black men sexually assaulting white women. But as she pointed out in her investigations, it was about destroying the black doctors, black business owners to enforce the poverty and subjugation of a segregated South. The ramparts you mentioned, Bob Scheer. Ramparts never made a dime, but COINTELPRO and that photograph of the child running down the road being burned by napalm and Vietnam and all of this comes out in the alternative press. We had used to have the Village Voice. We used to have a decentralized press, so there were far more alternative weeklies. It's always been the independent media that has shamed or forced the commercial media to begrudgingly accept reality. That's been transferred to the digital age, and you hold up Consortium News and other sites that I respect, run by Joe Loria, founded by Bob Perry, who I knew Bob because I covered the Contra War in Nicaragua. But we're, and you're right that that is where the hope lies, but I think the hope has always been within the alternative media. And you worked for an you write about working for an alternative media publication, which held these values. It was called The Guardian, if I remember. And, but we're watching it play itself out now in the digital age. And we're watching the heavy-handed state censorship move quite aggressively to crush it. I mean, I think that's where we are. I'm a little less hopeful than you are. I'm hopeful about the quality of the independent media and what can come out. But I think that the ferocity of the censorship is almost daily becoming more and more pronounced. And I speak as somebody who's been deplatformed, demonetized.
Yes, I know.
Hit with algorithms and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of points. One, in the book, I discard the term alternative media, right?
Way back in my youth,
I was a foreign editor at The Guardian, the American Guardian, one of the wonderful experiments of 20th century journalism. It lost its way in sectarian nonsense, but my argument now is that independent media should not understand itself, and nor should its readers and viewers, as an alternative to anything. It should be an autonomous, freestanding set of institutions, publications, whatever, broadcasters, that find their own way, and they're not qualifying what they read in the New York Times the previous day. I think that's an important point, the independence in the true sense of the term. Second point I want to make here is what we're talking about, the way you and I are talking right now. I don't know your technology intimately, but I it is dependent on these extraordinary digital technologies. That's terrific. Look at the explosion in independent media. You don't have to bother with newsprint anymore and all that sort of thing, right? It's out there right away. But this is the weighty paradox of our time. What has made independent media so extraordinarily effective over a very long period of time? And make no mistake, the corporate press is quite concerned about the challenge they've been presented.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Yeah, you're wonderful. I want to thank Diego, Max, Thomas, and Sophia, who produced the show. You can find me at chrishedges.substack.com.
DJ Namde from Radio Aphrodisia. Join us every Saturday as we nice up your weekend. It's all about music from Africa and the African world. Radio Aphrodisia, 4 to 6 p.m. It's Champeta Criolla from the coast of Caribbean, Soca Calypso, Juju Music, Musica Afro-Cubana, Cha-Cha-Cha, Afrobeat Highlife. It's all in the mix. Radio Aphrodisia, Saturdays, 4 to 6 p.m. showtime. Tune in.